Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Thank you so much for staying with us. And now we are going to be discussing something that is happening globally, but I suspect South Africans are not on top of. And it's so, so crucial for us to be a part of this conversation, because actually we are the kinds of people that need to be influencing what is happening in this regard at the UN. So what is happening there? There is a thing called a draft treaty on crimes against humanity and the struggle for justice and accountability for apartheid. And of course, we know what apartheid is all about. And many different stages have happened and are yet to happen. This is the fact that other nations, as well as ourselves, are meant to be making submissions to the UN on this particular draft, so that we are part of what makes history when things do happen. And so it's a long journey, and I just wanted someone to explain to us what this means, what this is all about, and how you and I can influence a treaty at the UN. And essentially what it is, in a quick nutshell, you've been watching the inquest, for instance, with the Craddock 4. You have been watching the inquest on the death of many people in this country, and you are told, you know, some of these cases date back to when we saw the beginning of democracy, and many, many, many families tell you that, you know, we are upset with this government, we haven't seen justice. The point of all of this is for families like families in South Africa and other parts of the world to see justice, and for apartheid to be criminalized. Now, we'll talk about what that means and how it looks in comparison to other treaties that are currently in place. So to help us with all of this is Senior Gender, Justice and International Law Fellow Wendy Isaacs, who's in studio with us, very kindly decided to come in to assist us with all of this. It's a mouthful, I know. We'll get there. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening. Good evening, Pamela. Good evening, listeners.
Okay, so we have this process, and I want us to just maybe quickly just give us a sense of what the process is and what we are talking about. It's a draft treaty that we are looking at currently, where member states are meant to be making submissions on a particular treaty. You'll explain what the treaty is right now. And we, too, are hoping to make submissions. So what is this treaty and what submissions are expected of member states?
Fantastic. So in very simple terms and very briefly, the UN International Law Commission has been working on a set of draft articles to criminalize various forms of crimes against humanity. And they've been doing this work for several years, as far back as 2013. That's when they started. There have been various processes. Member states have, since 2017, 2018, made formal submissions to drafts or draft articles that the International Law Commission prepared. Now, the International Law Commission is the treaty-making body of the UN system, and it's responsible, really, for formulating international law, and member states, through a sixth committee within the General Assembly, is responsible for ensuring that it is accurate and processes that. So this work has been going on for several years. Mm. What we have been monitoring as well is what have international NGOs, and NGOs in the Global South, of course, what NGOs have been doing while member states and the International Law Commission have been working on this draft treaty. Now, I'm speaking from the perspective of my organization, MADRE, and we've been working with several groups in the US and in Latin America for the most part. We've recently started having conversations in the Africa region, in South Africa, but most of our work has been in with groups in Latin America, in Afghanistan, in Myanmar, and other contexts to look at, or to consider, really, when the UN is developing this draft treaty, setting out various crimes, including the crime of apartheid, including the crime of persecution. There's a long list, at least 11 crimes. Apartheid is one of them, and that's our focus. How do they take into account specific contexts that are most relevant to the Global South? And here we're talking about gender, we're talking about class, we're talking about socioeconomic status. So where we are at now is after these years of engagement at UN level, at headquarters, with the UN system and other groups convening meetings in different parts of the world, including Geneva, we're now at a point where the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution in December. On the 12th of December, the UN General Assembly said, okay, now we have draft articles on this treaty on crimes against humanity, which are crimes of a systematic and systemic nature that happened during peace times, targeting civilians. And let's look at these crimes and how do we criminalize these different, or how do we ensure criminalization, accountability, and access to justice, right? And in adopting a resolution in December, the UN General Assembly set out a program of work to say, okay, now we have draft articles. For our purposes for tonight's discussion, the crime of apartheid is included in the draft articles. Mm-hmm. We have draft articles. Member states now have at least, off the top of my head, at least 2 years to make submissions. But at the same time, the General Assembly resolution is crafted in such a way that it allows for consultation with civil society. That's where we come in, and this is where this conversation comes in, to say, as South Africa, we have a moral and legal imperative responsibility to ensure that this particular crime of apartheid, not that the others are not important, but that this particular one is codified, it's codified appropriately, it is responsive to not only the historical crime of apartheid in South Africa and Namibia, but also to contemporary forms of apartheid, and for me tonight, particularly Palestine and Israeli apartheid policies and practices in Palestine.
Just as a way of background, we are now here with a resolution drafted by the UN that says, you know, okay, we've got draft articles and we need to now go ahead. How involved were our own organizations in the country? How involved was the state of the Republic of South Africa? It's important because I'm nervous that we are coming into this conversation at this stage. And I'm not saying it's too late, but we should have been there from the beginning. Have we been?
Right. That is an incredibly important question, and I'm glad you asked, because when I started working with the partners in New York, that was my first question as well. To what extent is the South African government engaged, substantively engaged, and not just monitoring? What we've been able to establish these past six months is that where the Sixth Committee has met, South Africa's really participating actively within the Africa group, within the UN system. So these are closed corridor or in closed corridor meetings, in closed door meetings in New York within the UN system, where South Africa is taking the leadership in the Africa group to push for the codification of apartheid, and also ensuring that other Africa group countries are behind it in terms of codification of this crime. Now, let me be very clear, because we met with the South African delegation in New York in March this year, and the legal officer there, and I'm not getting the title correct, but the senior legal officer there who's responsible for this particular agenda for the South Africa mission was very clear that all member states, and not just the Africa group, all member states globally do look to South Africa for guidance and leadership on what the crime of apartheid will look like ultimately. And so this brings us back to our responsibility. Now, how has the conversation happened within our borders? Has there been a national conversation around our responsibility as civil society and how we can input in the government's input and submissions? Personally, I don't think so. I have not seen it. What we have done as an organization is, we had a meeting in Cape Town in December last year on the sidelines of the ILGA conference to say, all right, there's a collective of international civil society organizations in the country, let's talk about it. But more than that, most significantly, in December last year, there's an annual meeting that takes place in South Africa among public interest litigation lawyers. It's called the Public Interest Law Gathering, in fact. And we, as an organization, submitted a proposal to say, we have, as South Africa, a new government of national unity. We have no idea what this government is going to look like, what its foreign policy will look like, what its agenda will be, and priorities will be. And it became apparent that what the conversation needs to be is, can we be certain that the position we've taken or positions that we've taken around international law, crimes against humanity, whether they're happening in the DRC, Sudan or Palestine or elsewhere, that they will be maintained in the GNU? And we had this conversation amongst lawyers. And what became clear was that there was concern.
Okay.
Right? But it wasn't troublesome, because when we engage with government, it becomes clear that it will be okay. When did it become troublesome exactly? And I want to go back to what should the government be doing?
Yeah.
There were maybe 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, there were reports that certain members of the GNU traveled to Israel and came back and reported that there's no apartheid in Palestine.
Yes.
And that now has got us really concerned as South Africans, because we know that there's ample evidence produced by the UN system, by UN special procedures, treaty bodies, international organizations. Palestinian organizations have been documenting Israeli apartheid policies and practices for years.
And most importantly, the ICJ has not ruled on that. So no one, you know, that someone preempts that and says there is no genocide as members of this GNU is quite concerning.
Right. What they're saying is that there's no, what they're saying is that there's no apartheid, right? So they're disputing genocide and they're disputing apartheid as well. Now, the ICJ has made it very clear that
the apartheid issue has been done
has
and
been
dusted
settled,
for a
but,
while.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the reality that we're dealing with, Pamela, and this makes this issue of our engagement in the treaty-making process that our government seriously needs to get behind really important, not just for us as South Africans in relation to, you were just talking about the Cradock 4 case, right? There's the report on the Kosas 4 cases that you've also covered. And what's emerging from there, to think about, as South Africans, we know that nobody has ever been convicted for the crime of apartheid in this country. Why is that? Sure, the president has set up a commission of inquiry to look into some of the South African president, that is, to look into some of these issues. The Foundation for Human Rights is taking leadership on litigating the cases, and I know that they're monitoring this Commission of Inquiry development quite closely. But the bottom line is, as South African members of the public, civil society, actors, the government itself, I don't care who it is, but if you find yourself within the borders of this country and have the protection and constitutional protection and guarantees of freedom and equality and democracy in this country, you have a moral and legal responsibility to ensure that this UN treaty that is being formulated in the UN system is informed by our own experiences, and that we're talking to the Namibians, because now the apartheid government took apartheid to Namibia, that we're talking to the Namibians so that they can also contribute to this. And this is about really about international solidarity efforts, right?
Yeah.
That we're talking to Palestinians to say, how can we, as human rights defenders, as activists, as lawyers, as civil society, ensure that our governments act with utmost credibility, responsibility, and ensure that this draft treaty is processed, it's adopted, and codifies the crime of apartheid in a meaningful way?
The codifying apartheid in a meaningful way is very important. We know that de Klerk, who's just passed on vehemently telling us that apartheid was not a crime against humanity, means that you can still have room for debate, not only just in this country, but you can have this debate globally, and you know, it's open-ended type of thing. Just how important is this codification, for instance, of apartheid?
For that very reason that you've just articulated, right? There is the rewriting of history that's happening in this country in many ways. I mean, we don't need to talk about how certain members of the public and certainly political parties and other countries are responding to efforts to do redress in economic and other forms of redress in the country. I'm just like going to flag the Expropriation of Land Act. Now, codification is essential because while apartheid is actually recognized as a crime under customary international law and also recognized under the Rome Statute, what we're saying here, or what the UN system rather is saying here, is that there isn't an international treaty that looks at these full range of crimes, murder, extermination. I mean, there's a long list. I don't want to.
No, go ahead.
Extermination, enslavement, deportation or forcible transfer of populations, imprisonment, all forms of rape and sexual violence and sexual slavery. Enforced disappearances of persons. There's a long list. I think there's about 11 crimes in these draft articles. And what we're saying is that there needs to be, for the crime of apartheid, and if we think about it in this country, there needs to be individual criminal responsibility. People need to be identified with when you are in
you
the business.
Did X,
you did one, two, three, which meets the elements of this crime of apartheid.
And therefore,
you must be
you're criminalized.
You must be subject to prosecution,
to
conviction,
prosecution.
And sentence.
Yeah.
Individual criminal criminal responsibility in a domestic court. This is what this draft treaty is trying to do. Do it in a domestic court, right? So when South Africa finally engages substantively, and when I say substantively, because they've made statements, but they haven't filed a written submission.
Yes.
To the UN system.
Yes.
And
that's essentially why we're having this conversation.
For them to say, tell us, what is it that will get you to the place as a government to make this written submission? Because South Africa can speak with absolute authority on apartheid. We want individual criminal responsibility. We want accountability. And connected to that, Pamela, we want, I don't want to say, use this general phrase that people use. We want victims, survivors to be heard. But absolutely we do.
But
and
you want...
We do.
But
want
we
that.
Want them to... Do you want accountability too, not just to be heard?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Accountability in the form of prosecution, prison sentences. We want people sitting behind bars. And let's just be very clear. I mean, I'm not going to mention specific organizations here, but there was a period where several international NGOs started talking about or documenting in a very precise manner the practices and policies in Israeli practices and policies in Palestine. Those reports that were produced by these organizations and even in the UN system became very useful for the International Criminal Court to think about formulating arrest warrants for Israeli leaders.
Yes.
What we, for this country, and I keep referring to Palestine because it's the most similar context, right? And you were just talking about it now. Also because I've been there and I've seen what that looks like.
Mm.
The point is individual criminal responsibility, accountability, but justice. What does justice look like? And this is where I need the next level of conversation to happen because we want to say to the government, sure, codification, criminalization. But let's also reflect on our own post-apartheid era developments, events, where we failed, where we could do better, and why this process is important, and especially important insofar as we connect with developments at the AU level. And I'm trying to do a very roundabout way of bringing in a conversation around reparations, because we can't talk about the crime of apartheid without talking about reparations. These two things go hand in hand.
It's going to rub people up the wrong way in this country, because we are great at I must be careful what I say. But we have been wonderful in going to the ICJ and really holding Israel accountable for what is happening in Palestine. And we also have to ask the harder question. If this treaty is drafted in a way that compels member state to really, and we agree on the codification, for instance, of apartheid in our case, then it would mean that this country would be compelled itself to do what it's asking others to do and stop dilly-dallying, which we've been doing since the TRC, because yes, we then made the commitments to go ahead and prosecute those who did not come forth and give us the right information and so on, but we didn't follow through on that one. And so this, I suppose, if done correctly and it goes through, this government would be compelled to do right by those who are yet to see justice.
100%. And the way you framed it is so critical, because our government needs to consider two things. It has a responsibility and, in fact, a constitutional obligation to ensure that international law is implemented, respected, and applied in the South African context. At the back of that, it has a responsibility to contribute to the development of international law and to respond to grave crimes when they happen elsewhere. And they're doing a great job at the ICJ with the genocide case. But what this does is it creates an opportunity for us to really get behind the work that is being done. And I'm going to mention the conference that we're convening on the 19th and 20th of June on this very topic, because we will have colleagues in the room from Foundation for Human Rights who will talk in very explicit terms about the cases that they've been working on and where our government has failed and what our government should be doing better. So it will be looking at both aspects. What are you saying when you take a stand, and an important one, and one that we love and respect, which make us proudly South African in international fora? That looks great, but how do you ensure that that is also happening within the country? But here, and I want to circle back to the issue of reparations. And I'm not an expert on the reparations issue in South Africa, so I hope that at some point you'll talk to others who are. When it comes to what reparations should have looked like in this country, there was a president fund for reparations, for instance. But for me, I want to break it down even further to say, what is the responsibility of business enterprises in the crimes of apartheid that were committed in South Africa? Connected to that is, if our government is taking this incredible step in doing the right thing in international law, how do we as civil society monitor what South African corporations are doing in the perpetuation of crimes against humanity in other countries? So monitoring both government and business.
Am I then right in saying that it will not just be a statement, it will be stipulated, so that we can stop dilly-dallying around what it looks like, what it doesn't look like, and then the back and forth of maybe, we can offer X amount or offer X rather than a directive. Mm-hmm. If we get this right, the globe gets this right, we could have a simpler process where it is stipulated what does justice look like, and rather than the tiptoeing around each other when sometimes it's convenient.
Yes. I mean, what there will be greater clarity.
Yes.
On what the crime is, who the victims are, who the perpetrators are, what should happen to those perpetrators, and what does justice
look
and
like?
Remedy for the crimes look like. We have an opportunity, things are kind of coming together, right, in the region.
Just to pause you there, just to make the point, because you had people really recently with the Credit 4 who had a number. They had a number that they were asking the Constitutional Court to look at. And there were people who were saying, what are you going to do with the money? Isn't it too much money? And that's exactly to avoid that kind of a conversation, right, where there would be some sort of a guideline to say, well, actually, this is what reparations or remedies look like for crime X or people X. So it will be a little bit more clearer, I suppose.
I think not through this particular treaty necessarily, but what the treaty does open the door for that. I think determining the amount of reparations for particular victims, for particular forms of suffering and particular crimes, that's
will
a longer
be a judge.
Process.
Having determined that it's a crime and you're guilty.
Yeah. What I think we need to do on that point, Rena Pamela, because it's an incredibly important one, and not just for South Africa or for, say, Namibia, which whom reparations have come up quite strongly in relation to the genocide committed by the Germans. But the African Union has declared 2025.
The theme for
the year 2025 is reparations. And they name the crimes. Colonialism, transatlantic slavery, and apartheid, right? And now, okay, whatever little faith you may have in the African Union,
yes,
that is not the point right now. Okay, nobody has faith in institutions, but that's not the point. The point is there is, it is the theme for the year. There are mechanisms, there are processes that the AU has put in place in Addis. There are processes, which means essentially that our own government is going to be engaging mm-hmm. in this AU system.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very specific objective in the program of work of the African Union for reparations. Consultations with civil society, mm-hmm. with experts, with mm-hmm. human rights lawyers, with mm-hmm. defenders, and with victims.
It's so important.
Yeah, exactly.
So important.
So there are ample opportunities for civil society engagement in both the UN treaty over the next, I think the time frame ends up until 2028. The program of work, it's a very long program of
yeah.
work. But starting kind of now in
well,
January.
Just to contextualize this, because it's important that you mention the African Union theme being justice for Africans and people of African descent through reparations. It's important, and I know maybe for us there may be a bit of a disconnect, but let's look at what's happening, for instance, in Namibia, where for a long time the discussions about reparations were between the states, Namibian state, the German state. And you would have many victims and families of victims and NGOs saying, we're excluded out of that conversation. Therefore, whatever agreements these states come up with doesn't look anything like what we understand to be justice for ourselves, for our ancestors, for our families. And there's always been that tension mm-hmm. about who to talk to, who to engage with, and whether there is what looks like justice even to the descendants of the people who can point to, that was my grandmother mm-hmm. that you persecuted, that you you killed and did all sorts of things to. So that's the reason why it's important to include in there mm-hmm. the consultations with families, with victims, and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, the one benefit that we have, and I think this again places a high level of responsibility on us as South Africans. We mm-hmm. have, just setting aside the Namibian context for a second, we have a vibrant and active civil society on all fronts, on all topics in this country,
mm.
right? We have a somewhat accessible government in mm. Pretoria mm-hmm. or whatever, wherever they mm. sit, depending on which government you're talking to. We also have Chapter 9 institutions in this country that mm. are supposed to be in dialogue and in conversation with civil society to say, okay, there are these cases, the causes for, the Cradock for, and I don't know the other ones that you have dealt with in your TRC reporting. What does reparations look like or apartheid look like? And for the Chapter 9 institutions, Human Rights Commission, Commission on Gender Equality, to convene civil society and survivors of victims of apartheid in this country to say, okay, this is what justice should look like for us. This is what we're trying to do on the 20th at our conference at the Nelson Mandela Foundation, to bring Chapter 9 institutions into the room to say, here's FHR sitting here representing victims and families of victims. Talk to them. What should this look like? In the Namibian context, again, I'm not super familiar with it,
mm-hmm.
but the point that I think you're getting at, which is an incredibly important one, is that the state level negotiation keeps people out.
Yep.
And so it's we have to take a step back and say, okay, how do we as people organize to make sure that our voices are heard? There's a provision, there's a provision in this General Assembly resolution, and that provision, Pamela, I want to emphasize and really acknowledge the South African mission to the UN in relation to this specific point. They worked incredibly hard, this is what we've been informed, incredibly hard to ensure that the provision relating to civil society participation
mm-hmm.
in the treaty-making process for mm-hmm. crimes against humanity is included and adopted. And there was a lot of pushback
yeah.
from many member states
really?
To say no.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll tell you why in our context. Because yeah. I just want to reference this just to make the point. I want to read just a tiny little abstract, not the entire thing, a tiny little abstract from the submission. No, it's not a submission. This is now the, do you call it a letter? What do you call it? It's a statement. It's a statement by the South African government. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this statement was released on 9th of October 2024 by the South African government. Mm-hmm. And it says, April 2024 marked 30 years since black South Africans regained the humanity they were stripped of for hundreds of years at the hands of a gruesome government under the regime of dependent racial segregation. And it goes on to say, we continue to endure the devastation impact of the apartheid policies, which were so intricate that it will take a lifetime of several generations to undo. Crimes against humanity are not an annex to the crime of genocide and war crimes. They are serious international crimes in their own standing. And it's a statement on behalf of the Republic of South Africa, 6th Committee of the 79th Session, the one you were speaking about, right? Mm-hmm. Under the agenda item 80. And this was on October 2024. Now, why I bring this up is that this is a statement that I believe they drafted and were working in collaboration, or at least whether it's in collaboration or in partnership with two other African states,
mm-hmm.
namely?
I believe it was Cameroon and I don't know.
Was it Ghana?
Maybe Sierra Leone.
Or Uganda.
Oh, yes, it must be Cameroon and Uganda, because Uganda was the...
And this is the point I want to make.
African Union group.
Exactly.
Leader. Yeah, Uganda.
So why what you said for me is crucial, and that's the point you're making about the fact that it was important for civil society organizations to be part of this process is precisely because in the context of South Africa, you have, as you said, very, very strong civil society, mm-hmm. very, very active, vibrant, and the like. Uganda and some member states in the African Union do not align with our constitutional values. And therefore, when we look at any submission, one would have to argue, you know, and it will be uncomfortable whether the position that our country is taking, being the leader in this case, is consistent with what our constitution values, namely gender issues, which we know some member states in the continent do not, you know, align with us on. Mm-hmm. And if we look at the items that you spoke about that we need to consider, whether those things will affect our submission or not.
Right. So let me try and be as clear and as precise as possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So within the UN system, you'll have the member states that they worked on the statement. There's the Africa Union group, mm-hmm. which will be represented by one government to another. Mm-hmm. At this time, Uganda mm-hmm. was speaking on behalf of the Africa group, right? Mm. So for that period of time, Uganda was the
lead
state, right? Mm. But South Africa is a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. So South Africa can take a position on topics that may seem controversial to other groups, but which are in compliance and in alignment with our own constitution. That will be an independent South Africa position. Now, again, it gets very tricky because everything is being negotiated in the corridors of the UN system, right?
Yeah.
And you don't know what gets given up and what gets taken away. Now, I want to say with a level of confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Level of confidence, because the person who read the statement before the Sixth Committee,
mm-hmm.
Advocate Motsepe, mm-hmm. Keke Motsepe, mm-hmm. she is actually the advocate that we met with in New York in March.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very clear that there is nothing that will be negotiable around the codification of apartheid, around accountability and justice.
Okay.
Now, there will be issues that South Africa, or that certain members of the Africa group, will not agree with in respect to South Africa, in relation, in response to South Africa's position. And this, for example, is around, let's say they want to take a position on gender.
Persecution of people
on the basis LGBTQ, of sexual orientation and gender identity.
This is it.
But this is not a new fight. This would not be a new fight. It would not be a new fight within the UN system. It would not be a new fight within the AU. Our government is fully capable.
Mm.
And they've dealt with this before. They've dealt with it in Geneva many times. introducing sexual orientation and gender identity as a form of discrimination, and the rest of the Africa group opposed it, violently opposed it almost. Yeah. They do it in New York all the time. Yeah. And what South Africa does, and this is why I want us to, I'm the first person to critique the South African government, but when it comes to finding ways to negotiate text and language, what I'm confident that they will do is to say, okay, there are gender dimensions to the crime of apartheid. How do we make sure that these are taken into account? Because the Africa group, Pamelo, is concerned with, for the most part, the rest of the African region. They're not even concerned that much with apartheid. They are concerned with the criminalization of slavery.
Interesting.
So you have the West Africa region. That's what they're pushing for. Parts of Central Africa.
That's why we're leading on the apartheid question.
100%.
Got you.
And so they'll defer to South Africa on apartheid.
Okay.
And when and
they will lead on slavery.
Yeah.
In a way. Okay.
Exactly. I think there will be a common Africa position.
Got you.
But then our work internally in this country and in partnership with, because we don't always have to be in opposition with government, we can disagree and put an alternative position which is more more in compliance with human rights standards. We can do that, but that's our job as civil society. But I don't see this becoming a
I don't see that, and I hear what you're saying. I don't see there being tensions between the South African public and government. What I do see, though, which is what concerns me, is we have not been aware that this process is underway. And I so appreciate you saying to me, yes, and you were getting clarity that there were conversations and things are happening at the UN level, and we have a committee that is leading this. But if NPOs, civil society, and the public are supposed to be part of this submission, we should be insisting that there's more transparency on what we're doing.
We need to get more. Let me be very, very clear. We need to get answers from Pretoria, not from New York. We need to get answers from DERCO in Pretoria. We need to get a position from DERCO on what they are communicating to members of the public here on this draft treaty. We need to get clarity from the Department of Justice, what their analysis, legal analysis, because they will be writing in many ways the substantive input for the government. DERCO and Justice will be working together. Okay. They need to say to the South African public, this is a draft treaty. It implicates your lives.
Absolutely.
This is about your history, your entire history as a country. This is what we're doing as a government. And these are the resources that we are putting behind this effort to make sure that your voices
and
are
how
heard.
We involve you
and how we involve you, and in a deliberate fashion, intentional and deliberate, to make sure that even as the major cases go forth, the causes for the Cradock Four. I come from a small little town in Ladysmith, where we lived it. I grew up under apartheid. If someone were, if you went into Ladysmith right now and said, what's happening is South Africa in apartheid. Sorry, I'm now diverting to Zoom. Yeah. But the point is, how do you involve members of the public?
We're going to take this step by step. This was just really a foundation of what it is that we're talking about here. And then we'll obviously then unpack some of the things that we just touched on a little bit. We'll have a four-part series. We'll also look at, you know, what does this codification mean? Because I want to simplistically say, oh, apartheid is apartheid is apartheid. Don't we all know what it is? And you have to then distill to us, know why it's important to codify and properly define it so that we then have it in law, stipulated in a particular way, and that criminalizes it. So what we'll talk about, all of that. And we'll also talk about the processes going forward. And again, why we're having this conversation, because you and I are affected by it and we cannot allow it to happen without our involvement. And how then do we bring this government to the fore? How do we engage them? And what does that look like? And what happens from now, you know, up until, did you say 2028, 2027?
The process has kind of started.
It has started.
The draft articles are available online. If anyone is interested in taking a look at what these draft articles are, they are available. Just go to the website of the International Law Commission of the UN. You'll also be interested, if you are interested in seeing what member states, other member states this have made extensive written submissions.
Have already made them.
Yeah. The US, for example, has made submissions on the draft treaty. I'm not going to go into details of what they've said about the treaty. They've taken a position. They've filed written submissions. The submissions of the United States government are available online. The Israeli government, and I'm mentioning those that are relevant to this conversation. The Israeli government
and the fact that they've already made submissions.
Has made submissions, yes. We, as a country, have not. I believe Morocco, on the African continent, Morocco, I think it's Morocco and Cameroon that have made submissions. Only two. Morocco. Hello,
Western Sahara. I don't think there's any. There are no surprises there. There are no surprises why Israel, the US, and Morocco would be the first on line.
There's one point I don't want to miss the opportunity to say this, Pamela. When people think of the actions of the South African government in relation to atrocities that are committed elsewhere, sure, we get critiqued. Well, the government is critiqued on not doing enough on Sudan or DRC. They get praised sometimes, but for the most part, for their actions on the Gaza genocide. What people don't pay attention to, and I'm going to recommend for those people who are interested in this, while the genocide case was being heard by the ICJ, and it continues, there was also the advisory opinion proceedings.
Yeah.
And these advisory opinion proceedings, or at least the opinion finally that the International Court of Justice issued in September 2024, is directly relevant to this point. And I want to mention it for two reasons. The General Assembly requested the court, the International Court of Justice, to issue an opinion on whether or not the occupation of Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory since 1967
mm-hmm.
is illegal.
Mm.
This is an old question. This mm-hmm. is a question, and South Africans will know this person, mm-hmm. I'm sure, and you know him as well. Professor John Dugard posed mm-hmm. this question in 2006 when he was the special rapporteur on the OPT. He said the question that the international community needs to ask is at which point does a prolonged and belligerent occupation become illegal?
Mm-hmm.
The International Court of Justice considered the advisory opinion, or rather the request, from the General Assembly. What South African government did something remarkable and beautiful. While they were busy litigating the genocide mm-hmm. case, they also made really precise formal submissions to the ICJ mm. on
that opinion
to mm. say, you are asking these questions about the illegality of the occupation, about mm. apartheid. Mm. This is our position. And the submission looks very clearly at, look at what apartheid looked like in South Africa, mm. looked like in South Africa, look mm. at what it looks like in Palestine.
And so therefore we can classify
and
we can, it as,
it's not even a question.
Yeah.
It is a crime, right? It is a crime. Sadly, and I'm glad that you're going to have conversations with other colleagues mm. who go into greater detail about this, the International Court of Justice didn't go far enough mm. when it rendered its opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It limited itself to concluding that apartheid just came to, that there was racism and racial discrimination in the Israel-Palestine context, and did not classify it as a crime, which makes
this
our
so
work
important.
Even so much more important.
Well, Wendy Isaacs, lots to unpack. We'll continue this conversation next week. We'll do this for the next 4 weeks as we slowly, slowly eke at it and try and all of us to get familiar with what needs to be done here. We'll also, as I said, share some of the submissions, as Wendy said. We'll get that online so that you can have a look. We have not, as South Africa, made submissions yet, but it's important for us to be familiar with what is happening so that we are a part of this process when South Africa finally makes its submissions. Wendy Isaacs, a Senior Gender Justice and International Law Fellow, and here representing Madre, as you said.
Yes, that is
thank
correct.
You very, very much for all of this.
Thank you kindly, Pamela. It's been a pleasure being here.
Click kaya959.co.za. This is how we do it. To download the Point of View podcast.